ब्रह्मणानि पश्चिकेति तरस्माद्वा एतस्मादात्मनः आकाशसम्भूतः आकाशाद्वायुः वायोरग्निः अग्नेरापः अर्घ्यपृथिवी पृथिव्या ओषधयः ओषधेभ्योऽन्नम् अन्नात् पुरुषः स वा एकपुरुषोन्नरतमयः तदेवमेव चिरः अयम् दक्षिणपक्षः अयमुत्तरपक्षः अयमात्मा इदम् बुद्धम् प्रतिष्ठा तदच्चेदश्चो भवति
So tonight, the Taittiriya Upanishad. What you heard there was the second Anubhaka in the second chapter, Brahmananda Valley, the Ananda of Brahman, the bliss of Brahman. This Upanishad is ancient. It's very nearly as old as the Brihadaranyaka or the Chandogya. It could be dated likely 1200 BCE. Sometimes it's called the Upanishad of Bliss. It's not just in this second chapter that the principle of delight is made prominent, but throughout. The whole Upanishad is a reverberating affirmation of the universe, of life, of our place in the universe. Sri Aurobindo translated this Upanishad during his days in Baroda and always wanted to return to it. There was only one occasion where he got to go back to the Taittiriya and do a little more work in it, and he inserted it into the pages of the Arya in 1918. Other than that, only with some occasional translations which made their way into the legends of the life divine, was there anything more from him. He regretted it. He wanted to work more in it because the idea of bliss as being the fountainhead, the real cause of the universe, was dear to him. The whole universe is a wave, a manifestation of continuing delight, is something that appears in his work again and again. So it's our pleasure to come to the Taittiriya tonight to look at some of its principal passages. What we just heard, of course, was a melodious chanting done in a slower style than you'll hear from the traditional South Indian Brahmins. I hope you enjoyed it, and if you want to have access to that, I can tell you how to get it. So this Upanishad, which is attached to the black Yajur Veda, the Krishna Yajur Veda, opens with an invocation to the gods. Vishnu is prominently named among them for the first time in the Upanishads. Then, in the second Anuvaka, the importance of how we say things is stressed. This takes us back to the Veda, where the metrical construction of the mantras is seen as homologizing to the universe. If you say the mantra correctly, with your consciousness in attunement with it, it creates order. It sustains the world. And so you don't want to speak these words cheaply or inaccurately. You want to say them with precision. Give them their justice. And so, we see this continuation into the Taittiriya, where if you say these verses correctly, you bring to you the things that they represent. The third and the fourth deal with how to bring into formation the things that you want. And the teacher's request that he be given earnest students, that he be given people who are straight and true. The fifth Anuvaka really gets us into the heart of the thing, because here he begins to describe the mystic what the fourfold order of the world is. And he begins with the familiar, bhur, bhuvat, suar. These are the three vyahritis, the great enunciations, the great utterances. And then they represent too the worlds known to us. So bhu represents the earth, the material world extended before us, of which we're a part. Bhuva represents the principle of life, of prana. Suvar represents not just heaven, just as bhuva represents life as well as sky, heaven represents mind. So already we have the three principles of existence with which we deal day in, day out. This is the warp and the woof of our existence. The mystic says, but besides these, Maha Chamasya made known a fourth, got to a secret, Mahas. We figure that as the symbolic sun. But the Mahas, the great, is that principle of Vijnana, the supreme consciousness, the great knowledge, which is seen as a world apart and above from the three that we know that are common to our experience. If one comes to know this fourth, this Mahas, one gets to the secret of existence. One becomes master of all because one has the greater knowledge. So again, in this Upanishad, as in the others, getting to the essential knowledge is the goal. But this Upanishad, like the Isha, is laying stress on the affirmative value of the world. So even though we get back to the root cause of all creation, we do not therefore abandon the world. Then, working on the idea that there are not just four, but a principle of five that go into the creation of things, sets of five, we find them leading us to an enumeration of the world that takes us beyond even matter, life, mind, and supermind, to a fifth element. So these things are homologized in us and are discoverable in us. And what is that fifth world? It is going to be the world of bliss. But before we go racing to that one, let's pause and see where they establish all of these truths. What is the common element? In the sixth Anuvaka, in this first chapter, the Shiksha, how to pronounce. This space that is within the heart, Hridaya, that is where the person is, the immortal, the resplendent, that which hangs down between the palates, that is Indra's place of exit. So the heart is the center of existence. Any heart is the center of existence because all hearts dwell in the one. And if bliss and supermind and mind and life and matter come into configuration and we can experience it, it's because we are there. Primarily, that is our locus. We are fixed in the heart. That is where the real person is. And that is where we discover the truth. Listen to this about how important it is to study. Ritta, the right, and also study and teaching. Satya, what is true, and also study and teaching. Tapas, austerity, effort, and also study and teaching. And so the doctrine goes on and on and on, telling us that whatever we're doing, we also have to attend to it. Whatever spiritual interests we have to be made assimilable through conscious reflection. We have to meditate upon it. We have to read, we have to ponder, we have to study for these things to become part of our nature. So this Upanishad is not simply declaring what is true, but giving injunctions, telling you what will take you there. So do all these things, but also remember, study and teach. Study so that you learn, and then teach so that you give. You receive and you give. There are many ways to study. It's not always with a book in your lap. One can pay attention to nature, can observe it closely. One can also teach in many ways, by example, through influence, not always by instruction, not always by speaking. The personal example is more important than that, and Sri Aurobindo noted in the Synthesis of Yoga that it is the influence of the teacher which is supremely important. So if you live what you study and radiate that out, it will have an impact. You find the mode that's appropriate to you. There's this wonderful verse in here where suddenly They have the voice of the Rishi speaking, who says, I am the mover, the creator of the tree. The tree here is the world existence. My fame is like a mountain's peak, exaltedly pure, like the excellent nectar in the sun. I am a shining treasure, wise, immortal, indestructible. This is what Trishanku, the great Rishi, said of himself, evidently in a state of rapturous union with the Supreme. This is not a man who was living a megalomaniacal life, rather somebody who lived in deep identity with the divine. So then in the 11th Anuvaka of this first chapter, he says, having taught the Veda, a teacher further instructs a pupil, speak the truth. Practice Dharma. Don't neglect your study. Be attentive to truth, virtue, welfare, prosperity, study, and teaching. But also do one's duty to the divine powers in the world and to the ancestors. In other words, live in a way that is godlike. Live in a manner that will make all the ancestry proud of how you behave, how you conduct yourself in the world. And be one to whom a mother is as a god, or we should say a goddess. Be one to whom a father is as a god, a deva. Be one to whom a teacher is as a god. Be one to whom a guest is as a god. You see the very roots in the Veda and the Upanishads of the famous hospitality that one is accorded in India. When you go to an Indian home, they receive you as a visiting divinity. They regard you as God come in a human vessel. And when you act, whatever Brahmans are superior to us, for them, refreshment should be procured by you with a seat. So somebody comes to visit you, you make sure they have a good seat. You give them a comfortable place, and then you serve them with faith, fidelity. You should give with real generosity, with modesty, with reluctance, and with sympathy. Sympathy, samvid, feeling the same thing they feel. And then, we come to the second valley, Brahmananda valley, the bliss of Brahma. And it states in the first, Om, he who knows Brahman attains the highest. He who knows Brahman as the real, Satyam, as knowledge, Jnanam, as the infinite, Anantam, set down in the secret place of the heart and in the highest heaven. So this is a threesome that anticipates the later idea of Satchit Ananda, existence, consciousness, bliss, which we'll meet when we get to the Brahma Sutras only. But here in the Upanishads, it is what is real and true, satyam. It is what is great knowledge, jnanam. And it's what is infinite. And where is that found? Not only in the highest heaven, not only transcendent to the world, but deep set inside of us. So if you can, in a sense, revisit the scene of the Upanishad, which is in a bucolic era, a pastoral setting, and the students are sitting near the one who is realized, because who wants to go and sit with somebody who doesn't live what they speak? You go and you sit next to a sage. And by dint of sitting next to that sage, what moves in him begins to move in you. Because he has discovered that the divine is not only there, but here in himself. He has the power of transfusing you with that same consciousness. It's a matter of wave after wave washing over and over the student before finally it sets in. But this becomes, again, what later we would call satsang. When you keep good and true company, you benefit from it. It pulls you into it. So here the sage is telling directly, this is the truth. That is in you. It is in that over there. It is above. It is the same truth. It is everywhere. It is one. It is Brahman. So, if you find that, then you obtain all desires, because in a way you become desireless, seeing that this one is established in all. There is nothing to see, because it's the same reality everywhere. So then, from this Atman in you, from this soul, comes space, Akasha. From this, the life-giving wind, Vayu. From the wind, the fire, Agni. From the fire, water, Appa. From water, the earth, Prithvi. From the earth, then we begin to see the herbs come, and from the herbs, the food, etc., etc. So, from the creative movement of the self, the subjective intent, yes, I will create a world, all of these various levels of the cosmos are made, they eventuate finally in earth, and then things begin to grow, begin to manifest, to flourish. What we see is a climbing back up this ladder of existence towards that from which it came. This is the person that consists of the essence of food. Here, the word food is anam. It means not only food, it means matter in general. Symbolically, it's food. And because food is precious to us, it's a good way to say that the world is precious. You want food. Food is a thing that gives you goodness. Huh? But say yes to the world. Don't deny the world. We've seen in the earlier Bali, perhaps I didn't mention it, but at the end of the discourse, the teacher sends all of the students back home. He doesn't keep them there in the forest hermitage. He doesn't keep them in his ashram. He says, now you have learned, now you understand, go back in the world, live a rich life. Affirm your godlike nature in society. Be harmonious in the world. Be great in the world. Live from the greatness of your soul. But live. And food is the very essence of life. He says in the second Anuvaka, this great sage, from food, creatures are produced, whatever dwells on the earth. By food, they live. into food, they finally pass, for food truly is the chief of things. Therefore, it is called a panacea. Sarvaushadham. Literally, it means consisting of all manner of herbs. Therefore, they obtain all food who worship Brahma as food. If you see the divine in all materiality, and you know your oneness with it, in a sense, you already possess it and are possessed by it, because that bond of oneness links you with it. You don't have to reach from desire for it. In a sense, it's already yours. You may have heard sages throughout the centuries have said, I don't need to eat. I am eating through your action. Through your eating, I am eating. When you feel yourself to be one with all, then the act of enjoyment that another one has, consuming food, enjoying conversation, having an aesthetic experience with art and music, it is all occurring within the one great self. If you identify with that, all is well. All is auspicious. This is one of my favorite anuvakas. Wherefrom words turn back, together with the mind, not having attained, aprapriya manasa. The bliss of Brahman, he who knows, fears not at any time, anything at all. So, attaining that superconscious home, becoming one with that again, you can't explain it. You can't speak what it really is. But once you have that, nothing seems horrible to you. Nothing moves you to fear. The word abhaya, being absent of fear, is a theme that recurs in the Upanishads and in later literature for generations to come, all the way up to the present. The thing that satisfies, the thing that liberates you from any concern, is this identity with the Godhead, with your real self, with your ultimate being. That is the thing that saves. It is also the thing that really satisfies. Now, what is being described in this second chapter are the building blocks of the world. The same that is true in our own experience of ourselves is true in the experience of the universe. We have a body. It is made of food, matter. We have a life force. It is made of prana. We have a mind composed of manas. We have a concealed greater consciousness unknown to us, which is the great one, Mahas. And above that is that realm of bliss. But so too, this is true of the universe. Like a layered cake, if you will, there is a material extension of the world. It's broader than we can see. But above that is a world of prana. Above that life force of prana is a plane of mind existence. Above that plane of mind existence is that linking world of vijnana, that mahas, that great consciousness. And above that is that oceanic delight, bliss, ananda. And all of that, in a sense, is telescoped into each. Interior to the body's experience is that life. Interior to the experience of life in the body is that mind. Interior to the experience of the mind living in the body is that supermind. Interior to that, causing all to come into manifestation, is that principle of bliss. This is true of the universe, and it is true of us. They are coincident. We are an individuation, each of us, as we grow, of that creative bliss of Brahman. All this universe is a manifold display of the powers and the ranges of being of that bliss of Brahman. I think to illustrate this, the Upanishad begins its third chapter, Bhrigu-vali. Bhrigu is the son of Varuna. Varuna means one who is oceanic. He is one of the great rishis of the Upanishadic age. And Bhrigu comes to him, approaches him, and asks to be taught, what is real? What is Brahman? And Varuna says to him, Brahman is tapas. Concentrate, practice tapas, and tell me that thing which begins the world, continues the world, and ends the world. So this young son goes and sits and contemplates and concentrates and does extreme tapasya and has a breakthrough realization. As he looks around, he says, I know. And he goes back and he tells his father, Brahman is annam, is food, is matter. Because from matter, all things arise. In matter, all things are sustained. And all things, when they dissolve, dissolve back into matter. And the father says, go practice tapas. So the boy goes back, realizing that he has not found the final answer. Performs tapas again, goes deep into austerity, and has another breakthrough. And he comes back to his father and says, Father, it is life. It is life, because from life, prana, all things are born, all things are sustained, and all things pass. And the father nods his head and smiles and sends the boy back to do more tapas. And so he sits, he contemplates, he arrives at a new revelation, and he comes back and he tells his father, Father, from mind all things are born. In mind all things are sustained, and into mind all things pass. The father is pleased, but even though he has seen that it is through the conception and the reflection of things in a still consciousness that this has arisen, this world, it is not the end. So the boy is sent back, and he does more tapasya. He sits longer. Finally, he breaks beyond the mind into this realm of solar light, and he comes back with his eyes ablaze, and he tells his father, it is from mahas, it is from vijnana that all things rise, all things are sustained, and all things pass. And even though this is the supramental great vision from which all of creation was organized, was formed into an ordered world, far above mind, far above life, far above matter. Still the Father gazes at his son and says, go, practice tapas, and discover what is Brahman. The boy goes back. He sits, he meditates. And when he comes back, his eyes are shining. And he says to his father, Father, it is from Ananda, it is from bliss that all things come. By bliss, all things are born. In bliss, all things are sustained. And into bliss, all things pass, and they're moving hence. And now the Father is satisfied that he has found the last great answer to the riddle of existence. It is not that the world is a hapless accident. It is not that the world is a field of suffering from which we must escape. It is that the world is a play of delight. In all of these ranges of existence, experienceable to us, are here for our exploration. But all of them are true. They are all based on bliss. So food is true. Life is true. Mind is true. The great consciousness of Vijnana is true. But bliss is that from which they all come. The original creative urge of the divine. Undefinable, but knowable in wave after wave of delight. So, I want to find this passage that is interesting, I think. One should make for himself much food. That is the rule. The earth really is food. Space is an eater of food. Space, akasha, is established on the earth. The earth is established on space. So food is established on food. He who knows that food, annam, which is established on food, becomes himself established. He becomes an eater of food, a possessor of food. He becomes great in offspring, in cattle, in the splendor of sacred knowledge, great in fame. What this means to say is that you don't have to have all of these things, but you become great by identity with the material world, recognizing that it is real, invaluable, and worthy. Then you live in its greatness. I mentioned Indian hospitality. Now, in the 10th anuvaka of this third chapter, it says, one should not refuse anyone at one's dwelling. That is the rule. Therefore, in any way that one should obtain much food, of such a one people say, food has succeeded for him. This food being prepared, for him, food is prepared. So if you give, then you receive. In other words, there is a consanguinity between your action, outgoing, and the reaction incoming. But all of it is based on a shared experience. So it's not that you desire things. This is a passage speaking about somebody who has attained a spiritual identity. Somebody who knows what he is, that he is Brahman, that he is the Atman, has no need of owning anything. But it's that we all flow in one bloodstream, that we're all together, that makes you do the right thing, and then good things come back to you. Well and good, you have no desire for them. You hold them desirelessly, and you release them desirelessly. He who is here inside your heart, and he who is yonder in the sun, that great being, he is one. He who knows this, on leaving this world, proceeding on to that self which consists of food, proceeding on to that self which consists of breath, proceeding on to that self which consists of mind, proceeding on to that self which consists of vijnana, proceeding on to that self which consists of bliss, goes up and down these worlds, eating what he desires, assuming what form he desires. He sits singing this chant. Literally, ha vu, ha vu, ha vu. There's another Upanishad, the Kanam, where the only expression one has having realized this great thing is ha. It's the great aha moment. Ah, ah. And he ranges through the worlds saying, I am food, I am food, I am food. I am the eater of food, I am the eater of food, I am the eater of food. I am eaten, I am eaten, I am eaten. I eat the one who eats. This is the divine experiencing all this delectable universe. Both as the foundation, as food, as the subject who eats. He is the subject who eats both the foundation and the one who thinks he eats. The grand all-inclusive reality. So, he who knows this becomes Suvarna Jyotihi, a supreme splendid light. And it says, such is the Upanishad. Such is the mystic doctrine. The Taittiriya. The sweetest of all the Upanishads chanted. I'm happy you could hear a little of that this evening. So next week, we will work a little bit more in the Upanishads. We'll take up two or three more. And then summarize what we've learnt in them as we prepare next to move into the Gita. So one more week in the Upanishads, and then 3 weeks in the Gita. But tonight, the Taittiriya. Do you have any questions about this one? I might mention that yesterday was the centenary observance of when the mother first met Sri Aurobindo in the ashram. What became the ashram? She came by boat to India and then by train up to Pondicherry. She got there on the afternoon of the 29th of March and went to see Sri Aurobindo at about 3:30 in the afternoon. She realized, as soon as she saw him, standing in profile, that this was the teacher who had been with her since her years as a teenager. Decades earlier, she had made a sketch of one who came to her, as she said, when the body was asleep. She would be working on her interior self. And a being would come, dressed in Indian garb, dark in complexion, with long hair and a beard, and instruct her about the structure of the inner worlds. She made a pencil sketch of that, I think, and set it aside. When she met Max Théon, a great teacher of occultism, she noted that he had long hair and a beard and resembled superficially that being that she had seen in her dreams years and years earlier. But the vibration was different. She knew it wasn't the same person. She heard about Sri Aurobindo through her then husband, Paul Richard, and was anxious to meet him. It took 4 years to make that meeting possible. It took her 21 days to cross the oceans to have this opportunity. Both she and Paul came to India, and in her memory, she went to see Sri Aurobindo alone at 3:30 in the afternoon. And she walked through those postern gates with the flower, faithfulness, as she would name it later, growing, and saw Sri Aurobindo standing in profile. I think he might have been gazing out towards the sea. He was not looking at her, just standing in profile. And as soon as she saw him, she recognized that this was the being that she had met in her dreams decades earlier. She said in a notation in her diary the next day, "It matters little that there are thousands of beings plunged in the densest ignorance. He whom we saw yesterday is on earth. His presence is enough to prove that a day will come when darkness shall be transformed into light, and thy reign shall be indeed established upon earth." I spoke with our friend, Vasanti, who said that the crowds in Pondicherry have been enormous. And it's very hot there right now. It's around 100 degrees Fahrenheit. And people are staying on the streets because there are no accommodations. But they're all happy to be there. They're in the place of their pilgrimage. And if they get a cup of water, well, that's the taste of tirtham from a divine hand. There was a special recognition at the railway station where Mother arrived. A stamp was canceled that will be available at the post office there at the Sri Aurobindo Ashram for the next 2 months. Special meditations at the playground. There was a run arranged by one of our friends, Ramesh Patel, who spent on the order of 2 lakhs distributing a commemorative medal to all who participated in the run from one end of the beach road to the other. We can't participate in a run like that, and none of us have been able to go to Pondicherry to be present for this. But that communion, that synthesis, that transcendence that Sri Aurobindo and Mother worked towards attaining, where the greatest spiritual consciousness is made manifest in matter, and where all the principles become harmonized in a soul that has grown to accommodate them, that we can strive to manifest in ourselves, in our own hearts, our own bodies, our own lives, our own minds. And if we're able to do that, then to borrow a phrase from Sri Aurobindo, we might just justify the light on nature's face. So if there are no questions, I think maybe we'll go for our meditation and gather again next Sunday. Namaste, Jai Ma. And I guess we should say goodnight to all of our friends on the conference call.
Hi. Hi, thank you so much.
We'll speak to you soon.
Bye-bye.